Welcome to this episode of The Cyber Show. This is it, boys. This is what we've waited for.
Let me give you a hint. Bang!
Yes, it's time for Cyber War. This series started because we had the opportunity to interview some guests who'd all participated in a documentary film called Midnight in the War Room. Let's hear from the director, Tom LaDuke.
First and foremost, this is not about technology. These are human stories. Mickey and I, the CEO of Semperis, are big movie buffs, and this is really a passion project. It's not a marketing campaign or anything like that. This is a project that is digging into the human side, the emotional side. And I think we're all kind of sick about talking about just the technology, and people are really excited about talking about the human side of it.
Of course, it's us humans that suffer. Ironically, cyber war is increasingly about machines versus machines, but it's us humans that take the brunt of it all, whether that means losing money, losing our jobs, or just losing our sanity in the ever-increasing madness of it all. It's not the machines that suffer, because, of course, machines can't suffer. Machines can't even think, no matter how much AI salesmen try to convince you that they can.
Yeah, what story keeps you up at night?
Some hackers that we interviewed, one of them, for example, was in a hacking group that was involved in a murder. So there are certainly those moments where you get chills. I'll just say that. I think it just shows how far we'll go to tell the right story. This is like an action movie. You have high stakes, you have heroes, you have villains. Battle-hardened actually really kind of break down. We've had people in tears. We're starting to call these sessions CISO therapy because hopefully we're asking questions that they've never been asked. Like, are you okay? How are you dealing with the mental stress of this? Like,
I wish we had time to really unpack that because we had Martin Smith from the SASIC, which is a kind of UK-based support group for CISOs. And the impact on everybody's lives is huge.
We've heard such a lot, haven't we, Helen, about mental health, stress, burnout. Made an episode celebrating the International SysAdmin Day on a similar theme of looking behind the scenes at what this costs people and the impact on them.
And I think one of the key issues is that when you are in an incident, you know, you've got a very small team, sometimes only maybe one person, and the whole company is now throwing papers in the air, sort of screaming and going, help us. It's your job to save us all. Put the fires out. And it's instant and it's a second. And you don't stop. Everyone goes home at 5 o'clock and forgets about it and sort of says, see you later, and leaves you carrying on, trying to put out the fire. And yeah, the lack of thanking as well. So it's not a very positive job.
Cyber war, the idea of cyber war is that there is some enemy out there, a nation state, whatever, cyber criminals, we're at war with them. And technology is the thing that mediates it. But there's another interpretation going on, and it's really big in society right now, and that's that we are actually in a battle with technology. I find that fascinating.
I agree 100%. I think that there's the very real fifth domain of war, which is cyberspace. Let's be clear about that. But then there is the war that we're in with ourselves internally of just how far do we allow our digital dependence to go?
Think about that Boeing 737 that went down, the MAX, with 150 people died, and that was the pilot, Yared Gitashu, pilot, battled against the computer controls, battled. And, you know, we don't need to go full Skynet or full Terminator before we admit that we've lost control of technology in many ways, in the processes, the industry. And so that's the cyber war.
That's where this film explores not just cyber, and we really don't talk much about the tech, to be honest, it's all humans, but we definitely explore human resilience. And that's a big piece to this.
So there is this huge human pushback against AI that we are beginning to see. There is, bad news. We're beginning to see for the first time that technology can do us real harm.
It's interesting because what I'm about to say is not directly to AI, but I'll come back to it. Going back to the human, we've heard in this industry so much that the human is the weakest link. And of course, that's true to a degree. But if you look at modern warfare, if you look at what's going on in Ukraine and Russia, the drones, we are really entering a time where the warfighter in the air flying the plane, it's kind of phasing out. We're going to have wars where machines in the air are completely autonomous, not controlled necessarily by any human. And so on one side, there's this sort of contradiction of the human has always been the weakest link. But if you take the human out of warfare completely, then you add AI to the picture. You add a nation state that's figured out a zero day to control all of our drones in the air and turn it against us. That's a scary day. So that's the intersection of a lot of things. That's the intersection of advances in technology and war. It's an intersection of asking ourselves the question of what it means to take the human almost entirely out of war, which is not a new concept. And also what it means with AI, autonomous drones and autonomous technology. That is a area that I am no expert in, but I can tell you that the deeper you go there, the more scary it gets.
One weighs 6 ounces, sits in a tree, and is very dangerous. A sparrow with a machine gun.
And I've talked to a lot of people at the highest levels of national security, and no one's been able to give me any comfort, really, there. It's a little bit like Terminator.
She'll be back.
Well, I guess if you look at the history and the technological path of weapons and warfare in general, it always tries to dehumanize the weapon itself, right? It tries to disconnect the human, the consciousness, from the weapon that you are using. Because the more the person has to get involved, has to see the face, has to get into that experience of death, the less likely they are to do it. It's why guns are preferred over knife crime, for example. It's further away, it's less human. Are we not just doing the same thing with technology? We're gamifying warfare, which means that we're going to end up potentially with humans that are completely disconnected from the killing, from the murder that they are doing.
We're already there. Technology enables all of that.
In science fiction, and there's at least three Star Trek, I mean, Roddenberry was really big on this, but it comes up in other bits of sci-fi, in which cyber war is the desirable form of warfare. These races on various planets and all arrived at the conclusion that war's a game, so we'll just gamify it and we'll have it all play out inside our computers and nobody needs to get hurt, you know, no bloodshed. It's just at the end of the day, we'll decide who won on the basis of some algorithm. And I think that that's a really, it's infantile, but it's a very appealing fantasy for many thinkers, including grown-ups who maybe haven't developed consciousness of consequences and understanding that that proxy is not going to stay in the box, right? You know, and so this idea of that cyber war, well, surely it's better than real war. And in a way, because it's always far away, if we just have a bunch of machines fighting in the desert on our behalf, now where's the harm in that?
Yeah, I'll just say too that the other sort of unique aspect of cyber war, of course, it's how it augments all the other domains of war, but also a cyber war starts much, much sooner. It starts targeting economy, targeting your critical infrastructure, targeting the psychology of your nation. So there are certainly aspects of cyber war going on now that the everyday person wouldn't tag as a war. There are certainly things going on now where somewhat of a precursor of something maybe much larger on its way.
We are going to be talking with Simon Hodgkinson all about Midnight in the War Room. Welcome, Simon. How are you feeling today?
Very good, Helen. It's delightful to be on the show. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the film. Why make it? Why do we need a film about cyber war now?
This production is all about 50 people involved sharing their expertise and educating the world on what it's like to be in cyber. Other than people being vilified on mainstream media or social media when they've had cyber incidents, nobody's ever really told the story from the other side. What's it like to be in the middle of a firefight? Anything from nation states attacking you, criminal gangs, insider threats, finding an insider in an organization is much harder than finding somebody externally. And so Tom LeDuc, Chief Marketing Officer at Semperis, and Mickey agreed to make this film so we could tell our stories. It's told from different perspectives, from ethical hackers, people from the world of psychology and also physiology, because that's a big part as well when you're in the height of a firefight, how you physically respond to those things, through to people like Chris English, General Petraeus, Jen Easterly, people that have had major roles in government agencies. cases. For me in particular, it was about telling the mental health side. It was unbelievably stressful, and I had the most supportive organization around me. Bob Dudley and Brian Gilvary, the CEO, CFO, and the board of BP were incredibly supportive for everything that I needed to get done. But when there were incidents going off, it is really, really stressful. I didn't sleep more than an hour a day for 7 weeks.
The film explores the real lives of combatants in the cyber war that's raging around us every day, and that most of us don't even notice is going on unless we become victims of it. Through our digital technology, our financial and banking systems, social media and websites, and not just our smartphones. Increasingly, we're at risk from ordinary household devices, appliances that upload our data, our cars, digital home assistants, as our data is sold on an international market for training AIs, for advertising and marketing, and all kinds of other reasons that expose us to risks we're not even aware of yet.
I did a video for a program called CIO of the Future back in 2012, 2013. We had to do a 5-minute intro on how technology was going to change the world. Everybody, these amazing strategic things about how everything was going to transform. Mine was on the negative impact of social media. And everything I said in that video has come true.
Yep.
But that's, you know, again, it's the consumer driving that. The technology platforms is a bit like a drug dealer. They're just continuing to feed.
Very good analogy. I often made that enormous parallels to legal and illegal drugs trade, preying on people's addictions, dependencies. I mean, we call users users. I mean, I'm not the first person to point this out. I think Jaron Lanier kind of on it pretty early, saying basically a drug peddling culture.
What about everyday people who have no interest in cybersecurity but still want to be protected? So we go into that as well. There's a sense of human resilience that we need to talk more about. There's a fantastic segment where we interview UK-based Rob Chaplin.
Rob, welcome to the Cyber Show.
Thanks very much for having me.
How did you get into tech? What led you here? And what are you doing now?
Yeah, so I guess my first experience was school, working out how to hack the school systems. And then when I was looking around for new jobs, I saw penetration testing advertised, applied for that, got it. And then that's been what I've been doing for the last 17 years or so.
Rob, you mentioned your previous life as a software engineer and that you'd done a little bit of work in testing and you didn't like it very much.
Yeah. So that was where I started. I started in software testing for an automotive firm, then moved into a financial firm, and then finally telecommunications. I mean, this is going back a while. There was no security element at all to it at that point. There probably is now. To be perfectly honest, I found it incredibly dull just checking whether things worked. It had a little bit of creativity to it, but nowhere near the element of pen testing. So it just didn't sit well with me. Like now, if you're getting involved in software engineering now, I wouldn't want to be there, to be perfectly honest. I think the combination of what you said about the rush to get updates out.
Absolutely disgraceful state of software engineering and this accelerating situation in which stuff is just shipped and updated. And in many cases, the updates themselves are the threat, you know, and so on.
Take video games, the amount that come out half complete and then they have to do day one patches and then they're patching for months and months and months to make it actually a workable thing, to the point where you'd be better off buying a game a year after it's released in most cases now.
Absolutely. I've worked on titles which were shipped prematurely and really almost tanked the company. What's happened is that the model has fundamentally changed. I mean, the idea of a product which is shipped as a contractually atomic unit and then the sale of goods kind of applies to that and its fitness for purpose and so on. All of that's gone and we've moved to a model which is effectively like continuous software as a service where you buy the idea of having an app and then development starts on it while then they kind of pump the code into your. I mean, this is absolutely bankrupt and it's going nowhere from a security point of view. I mean, that whole boundary of software as a product has changed completely. Not pretty.
I enjoy it. I mean, at that stage, when I was testing, we wanted a fully fledged product to be released. So, you know, down to is this aligned to the right number of pixels and things like that, which seems very different to what we see nowadays with, you know, in gaming, the games coming out, like you have to wait a year until it's playable to the same level as the previous game and things like that.
Shapland. He's an ethical hacker. Companies hire him to break in physically to their offices, but also to hack into their offices.
Pen testing is such a small part of an overall picture, right? You know, companies have pen testing because they're told they have to have pen testing. Generally speaking, you have to have it for your cyber insurance. In the greater role of protecting the country, I think it's what it helps mostly with is stopping the low-hanging fruit being exploited. Because in a pen test, you might have, let's say, a week to do a test on an app. You're limited by the budget of the client and the time you have available. A real criminal doesn't have those constraints. They also don't have the constraints of just testing a single app, which you might have been contracted to for a pen test. So within my role, if I'm doing a pen test, I want to make sure the low-hanging fruit on that app has been caught so that a criminal can't easily break in. Because when we see cyber attacks happening, it's nearly always the easy stuff, isn't it? You know, we always want to focus on these really complex hacks that required all this zero-day malware and everything, but the majority of them are just someone's done a stupid password or someone's opened an attachment or whatever. The VPN's been left with no MFA and your credential stuff in to get it. So the pen test is about, I think, primarily about picking up those things, making sure the companies haven't done anything stupid, because you're not going to find the really, really complex stuff unless you've got a client that's willing to pay for continuous red teaming and things. So yeah, that's what I think in a grander scheme of things. It's about enhancing the security of key companies within the country that could be involved in a, you know, if we were ever targeted by a war, there's going to be a cyber element to it. It's making sure those companies are resilient to the types of attacks that they might face.
We'll use our anti-crime computer in the Batcave.
Right, Robin.
Jesse McGraw, welcome to the Cyber Show.
Thanks for having me.
Jesse, you've been involved in Tom LeDuc's documentary film, Midnight in the War Room, which is about cyber war. Tell us a little bit about that and what you did.
I was interviewed for Midnight in the War Room just to give my perspective and experience as a former cyber criminal. I was the first person in recent U.S. history who was convicted for corrupting industrial control systems. And as someone who has been in the trenches on the other side of the law, telling of my experiences, how I came to transition from convicted computer hacker into a defender.
We are losing communication where we don't know what's happening. Things are not working.
And certainly, we've seen that nation states have the capabilities to take down our infrastructure, to electricity, water systems, communication systems. We have to expect there's a level of access that our adversaries have, everything that we are dependent on. That's not a new revelation or anything like that.
If you look at these tools Israel was using years before the attack that the U.S. and Israel carried out jointly in Iran, the Israeli intelligence, particularly Mossad, spent years actually infiltrating Tehran's traffic camera network, you know, mobile phone networks to monitor the movements of senior Iranian officials. Mm-hmm. I mean, years before the attack, the actual physical phase was carried out. So it really goes to show just how favorable cyber warfare has become. If this is at the forefront of conventional warfare, this is only what we know about, at least. And this falling into the wrong hands or being used with the wrong intention, like I said, it's a double-edged sword. And it's something that is like uncontrollable at this time.
We're doing the same thing to a degree. That is another interesting aspect about cyber. It's like people have talked about sort of the cyber Cold War. I think that's a really good way to think about it. Ongoing, constant war. I think the race for defenders and the race for cyber talent really kind of is at the center of that.
What I'm wondering here is how this awareness does translate into civil defense. Blaise Matrivelli, she follows Richard Moore actually before her, that said there is no boundary anymore between military crime and nation state actions. All of those old roles and hats and boundaries and uniforms, they're gone. And what kind of amused me a little bit, like the US Cyber Command and the Chinese too, those guys, they are in uniform. But they're in uniform in front of a screen. And I thought, why? This is to do with regulation, international agreement. This is to do with the definition of war. And if you carry it out wearing a uniform, it's a completely different world than if you're some kid that's 14 years old doing it for a bit of cryptocurrency, right? This really changes things in law, in diplomacy, in how we approach this. You're going to start calling this war and that not war. You're going to start calling that crime and that not crime. You're going to start calling that politically motivated or that financially motivated. Many of these really important distinctions that have kept society sane are vanishing, aren't they?
Yeah. I think the other piece is the business of the ransomware economy. People are shocked when I tell them that there's probably like an HR person that's at these massive ransomware operations. Like I was just interviewing Alex Weinert, who was the VP of Identity Security at Microsoft. He was at Microsoft for 30 years. He was there during the SolarWinds attack. Just the amount of thousands of people that actually worked on just that attack. It's a whole business. It's a $10 trillion a year business. And I think that's kind of what's interesting too about cybercrime and the ransomware economy is a lot of these folks probably get hired on job boards and it looks a lot more like corporate America than people think. It's a job for these people. If they're way at making a living, the emotion is removed. It's just a job.
Midnight in War Room is really a brilliant idea because the reality is real. It's not any type of fear-mongering propaganda. And it's an actual reality, geopolitical warfare right now, US, Israel, and Iran. Cyber war is the forefront of intelligence. It's important for people to be informed. Nowadays, what I do is I'm a threat hunter on a variety of cybercrime. I run a online child safety initiative for online child safeguarding, open source intelligence research, de-anonymizing threats against children for NGOs and law enforcement. So the end game is to try to reduce cybercrime and to catch those at the other end. You know, trying to give back to the world after spending so many years, you know, taking.
Just how big of a business it is. It's just massive.
And how organized. And we have heard. Yeah. And the help desks of these companies are better than anything. Can't get that kind of service from Google or Microsoft, but firm that's ransoming you. Yeah, they've got an amazing help desk.
Yeah.
There's a big difference, isn't there, between commercial espionage, exfiltration, ransomware, financially motivated crime, cybercrime, and cyber war. And when people start using words like war, this is a whole different gear, and I think it requires a whole different level of scrutiny and some much harder questions.
What do you think of the idea of a war now?
War it is.
It's war! War has broken out! This is a war!
That's it. Yes. It's war.
We have a number of interesting dilemmas or paradoxes with what we do. Well, first one's called the critic's dilemma. I don't know if you know this one. A couple of farmers see the hordes massing outside the Great Wall and run to the emperor and say, the Mughal hordes are coming to kill us all. And the emperor immediately has them both executed, doesn't want people upsetting everybody. And then, you know, 20 years later, the sons of them are they see another army massing on the horizon and they say, well, remember what happened to our fathers. Let's just keep quiet about it. And of course, the army invade and sack the city. If you tell people the truth, they're frightened and withdraw and they go into denial and avoidant behaviours. If you don't tell people, then they're underprepared. And I'm sure you share a lot of the same thoughts and feelings that Helen and I have in our work. It's really difficult to find that sweet spot. This is the critic's dilemma. How do you find the balance in your work? How do you keep it light and on message in a useful and non-alarmist way?
Great question. Because I've had clients in the past where I've broken in, I've provided them a report, and you just never hear from them again because they haven't got the money to fix it if it's a hospital, for example, or it's too embarrassing for them if it's a defense organization. So they bury the report, you don't hear from them again, and you know, you just never even get any feedback on what you've sent. So there's an element of trying to think about your audience and what they're trying to achieve, I suppose, in having a test done, especially in social engineering world. So sometimes I have a client that needs to do, most of the time a client needs to do a test because they want to highlight to their CEO that there's a risk, and therefore they can get some more budget and they can fix those risks. And it's, you know, it's a good reason to do a test, I think, if you think that there's an actual risk to the company. But I've had some companies that are doing a test because one of their key clients has asked them to do this as part of their due diligence. And then that's a very different story, because in one of those scenarios, my picture was sent to every single staff member in the organization before the test even happened. So you're facing a very different type of scenario there. So I think it's important to understand the context of what test you're doing, and therefore what you do and the report you write needs to reflect that audience. And I think that probably partially answers your questions. It's very, very difficult to adjust what you're doing to who the client is, I think, and not be too alarmist. So one thing pen testing industry has been very guilty of over the last 10 years probably is making stuff too high impact, saying stuff is really, really important. Like I go back a few years and, you know, you'd be reporting on a weak cipher or something like that, saying that's high risk. You know, well, it's not high risk because, you know, it's only in very specific circumstances you can intercept the data and decrypt it and everything else. And the data that's passing isn't actually that interesting anyway, because you've just blanketed it as a high risk vulnerability, regardless of what happens for testing. So we've always been guilty of this. So I think that the better pen test firms now have learned that and are starting to put things as, you know, low risk or informational, depending on the context and the likelihood that it's going to happen, because, you know, most companies aren't going to face nation state threats that are capable of decrypting this information anyway. I think that's another thing, is adjusting our reporting and our reporting style to make sure that we are not being overly sensationalist in how we say things.
And just raise the level of skepticism. I think that will help. There's a human resilience aspect to this. We're going to see more attacks like Colonial Pipeline. And I think that we need to face that and we need to be prepared for that. So one of the interviews, we spoke with a CISO who was very close to that incident. She makes the point that we all better be prepared for 3 or more days of provisions, gasoline, food, water. We just need to raise the level of our human resilience and be conscious of the fact that we are so dependent on technology. And how do we reduce some of that dependency and create a little bit more resilience in our lives?
Yeah, these are really good points. Let's stick with this for a little while, Tom, because this is a public service message, and this is very much aligned with what we do. You know, we interview people, we do vox pops, we're going into the street and ask people, you know, what do you think about cyber problems? And often it's, why shouldn't the government deal with that? You know, it's not our problem. So the idea of civic cybersecurity, as we call it, which is a broad digital literacy, a new wave of education. When you look at the first efforts of digital literacy in the 1980s, they were really to boost the economy. They were to create a new workforce of people who would go out and become the games designers and the software developers of the 90s and the noughties, and they built industry. But what we never had was, the comedian Stuart Lee talks about cyber advice as basically being Mr. Fox's guide to henhouse security. In that the common person, the advice they're given is so tepid. And so, as you say, there's no critical thinking in it. There's no challenge in it at all. Technology is used in a way to create a kind of docile and compliant and go along, get along kind of culture in which nobody questions it at all. And worse, the political classes too. You know, we have a real problem. One of our missions is to educate politicians, but at least insofar as helping politicians understand how large the gap is in their understanding between the reality and the fantasy of how we build a technological society. People that were in the Second World War, my gran and stuff, they had so much hardship, and so they had a natural resilience. I grew up in the 3-day week, winter of discontent, that sort of thing. The lights went off 3 days a week. You kind of have this idea that everything that's around us is precarious and it might just disappear any moment, and you build for that. But I think what we have now is a very comfortably numb kind of ignorance of, as you say, how dependent we are on the technology. How could filmmaking help with that without panicking people and making them nervous and cynical about technology?
I think the best recent example that helped was The Social Dilemma. That was a warning about a design from the people who created that design. You heard about how these apps on our phones are designed and similar to casinos in Las Vegas. They're designed to keep your attention, right? We've all heard that if the product is free, you're the product, right? So I think that there is a general awareness now about the downsides of social media, how much of our life energy and how much of our attention we should give to social media. And I think that there's a level of skepticism now. Certainly a lot of my friends have actually deleted most of their social media apps. It wasn't necessarily just because of the social dilemma, but it was the social dilemma in combination with other books and things that have come out about this. And I also think that it's changed the way that people are parenting. I've got two young kids and I'm very conscious about screen time and phones and even myself using my phone around my kids because I don't want them to see that all the time and screens in general. So I think that this is not going to solve everything, obviously, but hopefully it's the beginning. It's the first shot of a broader conversation around cyber.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on cybershow.uk.
People are very accepting of technology and of people who claim knowledge or authority around technology. That's a big problem. It's a problem because over 90% of all cyber incidents are caused by people getting tricked. We call it social engineering. We watched clips from a BBC television programme called The Real Hustle when Andy was training his cyber defenders. In it, Alexis Conran and Paul Wilson show viewers how they use stage magic and distraction to pull off confidence tricks. Now, I'd say that's recommended viewing, along with Jim Browning's Scam Interceptors. If everyone in Britain watched those, I think we could halve cybercrime. Here's what Rob had to say about training people to be wary of social engineering scams.
Then I kind of got into the social engineering world. I did a test as kind of a ride along, helping out on one. And then I did my first one up in London. It went well and got a kind of a bug for it, really. And then having that kind of technical ability combined with the social engineering allowed me to do things where I could hack in whilst inside the office. So you could just plug a laptop into the network, bypassing things like MFA, etc. Once you're inside. And then sort of took that knowledge and thought, okay, I could probably do some fun training sessions on the back of this. So then using hidden cameras to film the intrusions and then showing that to companies in their training to make it much more fun and interesting for the staff, much more engaging.
It's not some sophisticated cyber weapon. It's social engineering. Somebody posted with a geotag where they were on vacation. That hacker was able to call the hotel because they saw the hotel name in the background of the photo, get their logo and put in an email. So-and-so left a jacket or something at the hotel. And all of a sudden you have their credentials, might be a password that they've reused or what have you. So many of these attacks are still at the human level, playing into human psychology, urgency. And so I do believe that this film will help people just ask a few more questions before giving away their information. Think a bit more about their digital footprint and be a little bit more cautious about putting things out in the internet.
So when you say that you break into buildings, can you explain exactly how you go about doing that and how that relates to technology?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a whole process to it. So you could, if you wanted to, just turn up a building and try and get lucky and tailgate in through the doors as the employees open them. And that will work most of the time, to be honest. And a lot of companies that say they do social engineering, that's what they do. Because most people are kind and will hold the whole door is open for you and they don't want to challenge you because it's horrible to do that and we're British and we don't really do that very often. But I like to do it a little bit more formal. So there's a process to it. So the first stage is open source intelligence gathering. How much information can I find about the organization online? So I'm looking for things like building designs. I'm looking for ID badge designs. So most companies, you look on their official LinkedIn pages, Instagram, etc. Scroll through enough photographs, you'll find a photograph of staff at events and things like that. If you've got enough time, you can, within the individual people's names on LinkedIn, find them on Instagram, Facebook, etc., see if they post any photographs wearing their ID badge or something. So we're looking for anything that can aid us in the attack. What third-party companies do they use that we can pretend to be? So that's the first stage. The second stage is recon or reconnaissance of the building. So I'll go there in person, probably a week or two before the test is due. Sit outside, grab a coffee, walk around the building, whatever I can do. I'll try and be there as long as possible. So, for example, I was doing a test last week. There was a back entrance to the building, and I just sat on a wall for about 3 hours with a cup of coffee, pretending to be on my phone, and just watching this back entrance, see what companies come in and out. Is there any of those I can pretend to be? Can I go away and prepare an outfit that looks like that company, turn up at that entrance, you know, press the buzzer, and they'll let me in because I look like I'm from that company? So, you know, I'm looking for things like who delivers the printer paper, the coffee pods, who waters the plants, who's the cleaner, that sort of thing. But I also want to know what the front entrance security looks like. So are there barriers? Are there turnstiles? What do people wear to work? What time do they arrive? If I haven't found a badge design online, I'll take photographs of people as they enter the building and then use that to create a replica badge and lanyard. Security guards, you know, do they look like they're aware? Do they change positions? What time does the shift change? All those sorts of things that you could potentially take advantage of. Obviously, when you're doing a recce, if you stand outside a building for 8 hours, you're going to look a little bit suspicious. So you have to kind of be sensible about where you're standing and what you're doing, etc. So that's the next stage. Then stage after that is the pretext design. So how am I going to dress and how am I going to act? So this is where you create the nice outfit. So I've got a big box for a dress-up gear in that cupboard above me. There's all sorts of different outfits for different scenarios. So that's different cleaning companies, different employees, but it's also things like environmental auditors, plant watering person, all sorts of things that might get you in the building. And I have kind of playbooks for each scenario that's going to define how I dress and how I act. And you design the pretext based on the information you found in the previous stages. So if it's a multi-tenant building, it might be a different approach to if the company owns the whole building. Mm-hmm. Because if it's a multi-tenant building, maybe I can pretend to be the landlord of that building and I'm there to do something. Mm-hmm. Whereas I can't pretend to be the landlord, obviously, if the company owns the building. So all that sort of information is really, really useful to know. So once you've come up with the pretext, you then do the execution, and that is the actual intrusion, which might only take 10 minutes, to be honest. If you get lucky or your pretext works, then you might get in easily. My favourite pretext are ones where I pre-booked a visit with the company. I've tended to be someone, I've been essentially invited in. I might pretend to be a journalist or an environmental auditor or whatever. I've got the appointment booked and they're just letting me in. And now, unless they accompany me the whole time, I'm going to be able to do whatever my objective is. And I always get the company to define what objective they want me to achieve. So some might just want me to walk in, walk around the office, film something. Others might want me to get in and steal a laptop or get onto the computer network, steal some paperwork, get in the server room. There's all sorts of different objectives that might be set. And again, those define the pretext slightly, because you've got to get in the server room. You can't do it as a normal employee. So you need to pretend to be from someone from IT, for example. But then you're not going to have code. So how do you get hold of that code to get in? So there's all these complicated things based on the objectives that you've been set. But the execution might take 10 minutes, might take a whole day. And then the last phase is the most boring part, which is the report writing, which is obviously what the value the client gets at the end of it. And then that will include edited videos and things like that as well. And then nearly always on the back of that, I'll then do in-person training sessions for the client, because it's a massive wasted opportunity if you've got those really great videos of you breaking in to not then use them to raise staff awareness as well. So that's kind of the whole process. But you know, each part might take a day or two, depending on how big the company is.
You know, cyber is often a mix of physical and cyber. If you want to get out of the technology, you just physically break in with a coat hanger by pulling the fire door down where the alarm's been disabled and walk out with the technology. That simple, right? Go into a retail station, put a skimmer on. If there's a card skimmer, it's really easy to do. Walk into any building with a lanyard. Most people will go, oh, okay.
Same dual entry system in every single building pretty much in the UK. And you can literally buy that from Amazon and print your own card and just walk in and go boop on the door if you're lucky enough. If you can infiltrate that one server, you're in. You're into every door. You look like an employee.
Another really interesting topic in the film, we interviewed Joe Tidy at the BBC, and he spent a lot of time interviewing teenage hackers. Folks don't know this. We have a $10 trillion cybercrime industry, and some of the major players in that industry are like 14, 15-year-old kids. Some of the major hacking groups like Scattered Spider, who aren't just after money, they are kids.
I got started in cybercrime very early. For me, it began with me as a victim. I used to spend a lot of time on internet relay chat, you know, IRC. I made a choice. I didn't want to be a victim anymore. So I thought I would take it upon myself to teach myself everything I could possibly learn about hacking so that I would never find myself in a position of weakness ever again. You know, while I wanted to be in a position of power and not become a victim, I turned around and, you know, used social engineering to create victims for myself, which was very, very foolish, but I was also just a kid.
And further, these kids get recruited into cybercrime, often through gaming and gaming communities.
And last night, my 8-year-old playing a game on Roblox that trains me to be one of a bad guy.
Right. How do we make defending just as cool as being on the other side? Lowering the barrier of entry. There shouldn't be a requirement for a 4-year degree anymore to go into cyber. A lot of the certifications are already sort of out of date.
Earlier on, during the pinnacle of my hacking days, back from 2006 to 2009, you know, there weren't a lot of opportunities like we have today. Nowadays, you don't really need certifications to vet your skills. You just need to get up on the scoreboard on HackerOne, on TryHackMe, and these cybersecurity training platforms, or do bug bounties, which don't require any certifications. But back in my time, those certifications spoke for everything. Making that transition was a lot harder because the industry didn't have a welcoming approach to bringing hackers out of that environment and providing them with something productive. Back then, it wasn't really a thing. I mean, we always had offensive security, but not as embraced as we have it now. The infrastructure wasn't there. The training, embracing people into a better journey through a cybersecurity career. But it was realized over time, and that's why the industry began to expand and to accept hackers and to create an avenue that didn't really require certifications. You know, hackers scoff at them. They don't prove that you're good at what you do. They prove you're a good test taker. This is why people who have certifications, who build infrastructures that are supposed to be secure, are hacked. Their databases are breached. Their websites are defaced. You know what I mean? These are the people who have the certifications. It proves that the piece of paper really is just, you have the knowledge, you took a test, you passed it, but like the real life execution of it, it might not be the same.
This is a big message that Marcus Hutchins, who's in the film, he's also known as the WannaCry hero. He basically single-handedly stopped the WannaCry attack. He goes into this and he's very passionate about this topic. We've got to get more creative about recruiting talent and nurturing talent and finding talent in areas where they're not traditional paths. Make it easier for folks to build a career in cyber. And that includes loosening our thoughts on criminal records. We've got to get better at creating a more inclusive environment in the cyber industry.
There's a huge crisis in higher education at the moment. It's tragic. I had to quit one institution because effectively we were training our future enemies. Very clearly, people were coming onto a 3-year degree course with expectations of job opportunities at the end that they weren't getting. And you could tell exactly where they were going in life because they said so. It's like, you know, I'm going to use these skills to make money. Yeah, I think it's a noble idea to motivate, to inspire young people. I think it's very, very difficult. I'm not sure how you reach them. I'm not sure if fiction helps. I'm not sure if documentary helps. I'm not sure what messaging helps, but it's part of what we're doing with the Cyber Show all the time. Yeah. And it's not just young people. Older people who are not necessarily thinking of themselves as being good at computers at all, but they're just good security thinkers. Definitely wish you a lot of success with that mission.
Hacking and tinkering are our brightest minds and, you know, the best innovators. They have that instinct. So I actually think if you're a young person and you're really excited about hacking, follow that passion. Just make sure you go towards the right path.
A profound paradox at the heart of this problem is that while we desperately need people to be better at cyber, to raise the standard of digital literacy again, neither governments nor giant tech corporations want a technically literate population. If people understand technology, they ask questions. They can see when politicians or product vendors are being dishonest. If they discover free open source alternatives to Microsoft and Google, they soon figure out that those are better than the commercial cloud offerings. They even figure out that they can write their own software and tailor it to their specific needs. Education liberates and democratizes digital technology. And that's bad for people who've grown used to using tech to control other people. The paradox is that the only path to real cybersecurity is not authoritarianism, but knowledge and awareness. If people remain ignorant subjects of a technocratic regime, everyone, including the regime itself, will always be insecure. Interestingly, this means that citizens are also combatants in the new cyber war. They're fighting for their digital rights, for the right to understand and control the technology now central to their lives.
I'll give you an example. So going back to Marcus Hutchins, now he actually got arrested just a few months after stopping one of the largest, most destructive cyber attacks of all time. He was actually arrested for a crime he did years back, building and selling malware. And so he goes into, in the documentary, how he had a complete disconnect around what he was building, which he's into the tech. Like he's into the weeds. He likes the tech. He likes to build the tech. And that's what fascinates him. And he's really, really good at it. But he didn't think downstream of what happens when somebody purchases this malware from him. He didn't think about what would happen when a criminal organization holds, you know, a hospital for ransom. So I think part of this is just bridging that disconnect, especially for younger people who are tinkerers and hackers, and making it clear that there are real world consequences. Stories can do that. You don't have 14-year-olds necessarily reading the Wall Street Journal, but you do have them on Netflix and Hulu, and you do have access to them through stories.
Wonderful use of storytelling. There's a BBC program about cybercrime. It's about fraud, things like that. They'll interview people and you'll see somebody breaking down crying. You know, they've lost all their savings. Husband's committed suicide because they've lost the house. They're crying on camera. They're absolutely devastated. And week after week, you see this. Making that connection of actions and consequences is certainly very important. On the other hand, we see software companies making bossware, making spouseware, making things to track kids. Kids grow up with their parents putting trackers on their phone. People grow up in an environment, young people grow up in an environment in which technology is highly abusive towards them and towards other people. You've got companies like Israel's NSO Group openly selling malware internationally. You've got even companies like Microsoft and Google committing really quite awful intrusions and violations of people's digital rights, privacy, autonomy, dignity, and so on. So what's happening is I think the young generation are growing up with a sort of contempt, and it's worse than it was when I was a kid, because we had this idea, you know, from War Games and things like that. Everyone thought War Games was a really funny film because it tried to situate cyber exactly as we're saying now. This is very serious, you know, type the wrong thing, you could cause a nuclear war. But everybody really knew. This is like a disembodied, disconnected world. For the most part, people who perpetrate bad things never have to face the consequences of their action.
Jen talks about $10 trillion by the end of this year. I think it was the end of this year. So it's only ever going to get worse from this situation, in my opinion, because low cost of entry, very, very low risk of being apprehended, and it's extremely high reward. If that was a legitimate business, you people would be piling into it. So, and that's what's happening in the cyber world. You're getting more and more disaffected people that are seeing it as a vehicle to make money. You know, the point is, let's use this film in a way that's going to grab attention and be really interesting to the masses.
This seems like a gargantuan task to confront. It's such a huge challenge. And the Reef lectures, very popular lectures on the BBC recently, in which a prominent anthropologist is calling for a moral revolution, and particularly around technology. Do you feel these sentiments too? Do you feel that like tech is creating an anything goes culture in which young people will naturally gravitate towards crime?
I certainly think the cyberspace enables behavior that otherwise you wouldn't do in the real world. There certainly are people who would happily steal your Bitcoin, and there's an anonymity to that where they're emboldened by the fact that they won't be held accountable. But that same person would not hold up a convenience store and rob the store, right? They wouldn't do that in the real world.
They wouldn't have the courage, presence and courage.
And convenience too, it's kind of scary. One of the things about cyber is the asymmetrical aspect of it. The fact that you can buy on the dark web for a couple of bucks the most state-of-the-art cyber weapon that last week was developed by a nation state, and now it's available to you.
During the onset of the war between Russia and Ukraine, there was just rampant cyber attacks against all types of civilians, hospitals, nuclear power plants, all types of things that have no scope in any type of, hacktivism. And so even companies were trying to create a line between cyber terrorism and hacktivism, because even though it does cross into a illegal gray area, you're never going to get rid of hacktivism. So someone has to advocate for some type of line so that people know, hey, maybe attacking a hospital isn't the best thing to do when protesting a war.
So there are some moral questions and there are some societal questions that we explore in the documentary on this. And actually, there's a fantastic segment with Mary Akin, who goes into this from a psychological standpoint. And she actually thinks that cyber is revealing something about humanity that we haven't seen in a long, long time. I won't spoil it for you, but there's a fantastic moment where she has probably one of the most interesting insights that I've heard on this topic.
That sounds brilliant. I love these kind of more philosophical and psychological insights. And I think that that's really the key, the way forward, not technical solutions. We need to figure out what's going on when you pick up technology as a tool, you stare into the abyss, but the abyss stares back at you. And the moment you're connected to the rest of the world or to somebody else in this very asymmetrical consequences situation, then it's like really reveals who you are as a person.
Right.
And I think we've known that, like going right back to early days of the net, some people would just be egalitarian, just take it as an opportunity to spread kindness and love and to help everybody out. And a lot of the early internet comes out of this huge energy of cooperation and mutuality and so on. And then it's only after the eternal September and the commercialization when suddenly a whole new wave of people come along and they say, you know what, I can just get what I want from it. I can just take. And so now young people see people like Mark Zuckerberg, who basically said, you know, people that give me their data, they're dumb fucks. And they say, well, I should emulate him because he's a multi-billionaire.
Yeah, it's interesting.
What are your opinions on civic cybersecurity and how we protect everybody? I mean, one of our things is we believe in education. We believe we should start teaching kids about cybersecurity when they're 5 years old.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think you start early with kids because, you know, we've grown up in a, well, I certainly grew up in a, where technology was coming through as I was growing up. You know, I didn't have a mobile phone at 10 years old like you do most kids nowadays. You know, for most kids, having a mobile phone is a requirement of being in secondary school, which I personally believe is utterly ridiculous. But we are in a society where kids are going to have social media. They're going to have, well, you know, 10 years time, what are they going to have? It's very difficult to predict. But security is always going to be a thing. So I completely agree with you, teaching them early about how to protect themselves, about what scams look like. Because at the end of the day, if they're going to be scammed out of something, it's going to rely on the same psychological tricks that is always relied on. So you can teach them the fundamentals of those things from a very young age. And although it feels a bit weird to making your kids suspicious, you kind of, you know, you already say don't take sweets from strangers, right? It's the same concept in a cyber way, really. Completely agree with you that it's really important to do that, and the earlier the better, absolutely.
I was going to say that it's an extension of parenting that you're already doing. You're already teaching them about burglars and stranger danger. It should be an extension of that, but that doesn't stop. It's not just out in the playground or out in the street. It's also in the digital world as well, and they don't find that too difficult to understand at five. They really don't.
No, exactly. And you need to teach them about cyberbullying and everything as well. And that whole world of social media pressure. And it's just, yeah, it's very, very difficult with kids. So absolutely, yeah, the earlier the better.
Yeah, it gets really awkward when they're 13 and you're like, come here and let's talk about sextortion. They're like, ah!
Absolutely. Say it again.